All right, welcome to class today. Before we begin, are there comments, questions, or other things for me? I didn't expect so. It's not like I can do anything about your horse. This is my last day helping you out. Next week, you will have Professor Rice back, as usual. Let's dive in. We left off last time. I believe we ended as we had just sort of looked at the idea of multiple issue, a processor that can start multiple instructions in the same cycle, and out of order, a processor that could finish a later instruction before an earlier instruction. And so we're going to pick up by thinking some more about those kinds of things and how they get implemented, and then get to some of how this helps us write good, better code at the end of class today. So let's start with this little diagram. I believe this is the sort that you're used to seeing. Except, of course, it's got an extra oddity here. I have out-of-order execution. Now, the actual order that we're making things run here, I'm not explaining. Maybe there's something before this slide that's changing the order or so on. But if this is the stages things happen in, we have a problem that we did not have with a basic pipeline. So in basic pipelines, although they probably didn't seem basic when you were implementing them, but in basic pipelines, we had to deal with data forwarding. We had to check some earlier pipeline register to see if it had a more up-to-date value with the thing we're trying to handle than the one that's in the register file. And the way you did that was by checking the destination addresses of all of the previous pipeline registers and taking the most recent one. Well, if we do that here, we will grab the wrong R8. Because the first instruction will have a forwardable value of R8, but there's been a more recent instruction that's already finished and put its thing back in the register file that doesn't. That should overwrite it. Okay? And so, in addition to the already complex piece of forwarding logic, we now have this extra challenge that we need to know, was it the right instruction, which we cannot get simply from the pipeline registers. Let's also look at one that has both multiple issue and out of order. And we have a kind of problem we have never had before. We have what's called a write-after-write hazard. The two highlighted write-back stages are both supposed to write values to R8. There's actually another one that writes value to R8 in between. But these two are both supposed to write values to R8. And the one that finishes first is the one that should end up in the register file, and the one that finishes second should not. So even if we could somehow figure out the fancy forwarding we have to do, we would end up with the wrong value in the register if we allow these write-backs to happen in the order listed. And so we're going to have some fancier control to make sure this doesn't happen and to somehow avoid these two kinds of fancier hazards if we want to allow this kind of processor to work. Now, the easy way is just say, every instruction depends on any other instruction that uses the same registers and make them all stall until the one before them finish. But we can do something better than that. And the something better than that we're going to do is going to be caused by changing our registers. We are not going to use the registers the programmer gives us. We're going to use different registers. So let's explore briefly how this fits into the pipeline, then we'll see how we actually do this. So this is Professor Rice's illustration of an out-of-order multiple-issue processor. So let's sort of walk through some of the pieces here. We'll spend most of our time sort of in the middle of this picture today. Let's make sure we understand what's going on. So let's start at the beginning. Hopefully you're all familiar with this idea that I have a program counter that goes into my instruction cache to get an instruction out. Although with multiple-issue, I'm going to grab several instructions, not just one. And so this first pipeline register is going to have room to store all of the information about multiple instructions concurrently. And then I'm going to have to decode it. As we're going to see here in a moment, this is going to be a more involved operation once we start changing registers and so on. So there's actually going to be some parsing and understanding of the instruction we're going to need to do in its own stage. So the register read kind of idea we're thinking about, we're actually going to do down here. And this decode is going to have this other kind of process we'll get to near the end of class today. You'll also notice we have two cycles of branch prediction. When we have a lot of instructions running all at once in parallel, possibly out of order, it is quite possible for a mispredicted branch to mean we have many, many instructions we have to throw away. So the cost of branch misprediction is going to go up quite a lot. A reasonable estimate in a modern processor is one mispredicted branch costs you between 10 and 20 cycles of execution. Not the one or two that we were getting out of your branch mispredictions in the pipe simulator you were building. Okay? And so when we're losing 10 or 20 cycles, it's worth our while having this fancy history of what we've done based on code addresses and so forth. And we're going to actually do it twice, once based only on the PC, once when we have the additional information about what instructions we're loading. We're going to use that to try to make the best branch prediction we can right up front. Then we have this magical step called renaming, where we throw away all the registers the programmer gives us and use different ones instead. We'll talk about that next. We have this weird instruction queue. Because instructions can happen out of order, we're going to need some sort of data structure. This is not going to be really a queue, but more like a priority queue kind of structure, where we want to execute the oldest instruction we can execute. And so we'll explain how we understand that idea of being able to execute a thing there. Then we're going to have our reading and forwarding ideas. And then you notice here we have, in parallel, a bunch of functional units, as they're called. This is sort of like the execute stage and the memory stage. Several of them, they don't all have to be the same. Some of them can be more complicated than others. So we have here our load store, which is going to the data cache. We also have this two-stage ALU with its own little pipeline register in between, and two one-stage ALUs. And we'll talk some more about why we might think about designing something this way. Then we have our write-back stage, which, because of the register renaming, becomes more complicated and actually needs its own stage. And then we have some commits that make sure that if we mispredicted, we figure out what we need to throw away, and if we still have something that could be a misprediction, we're waiting to finish it all out until we're done. So we're going to talk primarily about these sort of middle stages here today. And you'll learn some more, as I understand, most of the rest of this will be covered in coming weeks as you understand more about how branch prediction works and so forth. So let's just dive in. I think the best way to explain how we're throwing away the old registers and using new ones is just walk through an example. So what we're going to do in our hardware is we're going to have this register map. For every architectural register, okay, architectural meaning in our instruction set architecture, RIX through R15, the ones you've been using, those registers, they're going to appear in the assembly. They're going to be in the code we load in. But we are going to map them to some other physical register. Those are not going to be physical registers. They're going to be abstract notions. We have already given up on actually implementing some things the programmer thinks they have. For example, with the sequential processor, the idea of one instruction at a time was actual truth. With a pipeline processor, we're just pretending to do one thing at a time. We're actually doing several at a time and maybe trying something out and throwing it away and so on. So we've given up the idea of one at a time. Now we're going to give up the idea of actually using the registers they said they were using. We're going to guarantee, just like the pipeline guarantees the same behavior as a sequential processor, this is going to guarantee the same behavior as if we'd use the register they asked us to. But just like the pipeline, we're going to be able to do more things at once and do it faster by using our special different registers instead. And so we have this table of what we're going to map each of these registers to. There is no significance to the numbers in this table. They are random numbers. They're just whatever the program has gotten to after running for a while. And we're going to change them multiple times as I go through this process. So I have some registers here that map to physical registers, architecture to physical registers, and some extra physical registers over here. One other thing to note here. Two other things. One is this percent sign X, that's just Professor Rice's way of trying to make this look like a register. We don't have an assembly notation for physical registers because we can't talk about them in assembly. So there is no need for a notation, so there's no standard notation for them. They are registers, and hopefully by this point you see a percent sign and think register, but they're different than the ones you're used to, so X different, I don't know, something like this. Okay. The other thing to note here is there are only 16 architectural registers. But you'll notice I have numbers like 19 and 24. I've got more than that physical registers. We're actually going to have a lot more. Modern architectures might have something like 200 physical registers for 19 architectural. And we're going to see we're going to actually use several of them for one architectural register as we go forward. Yes?
So are these abstract registers that is places in memory? Or like
these physical registers are registers on the chip.
Oh, okay.
They are physical registers. So a register file is not going to have one for each architecture register. It's going to have a whole lot of physical ones instead. Other questions? All right, let's do the work. The basic idea here is going to start out pretty simple. You give me an add instruction. I'm going to use an add instruction. Then I'm going to change the registers based on my lookup. So register 10 turns into physical register 19. Because that's what's in the table. Register 8 turns into physical register 13. However, I'm going to fix a problem from an architectural standpoint of my old registers. My old registers had the property that multiple instructions could write to the same one. And I don't want that to be the case, because if I have two instructions could both write the same register, then I have to ask which one was most recent. So every single time an instruction is going to write to register, I'm going to give it a brand new register to write to. So this is writing to register. I'm going to have it write to the first free register, x18. That's no longer free. It is being written by my first instruction. And for all future time, when you see r8, you should use x18, not x13. So for all subsequent instructions, when you see R8, you must have meant the one I wrote, not the one that existed before. Now I have another instruction. It's also writing to R8, so I'm going to translate this one, rename it. R11 is X7. And R8 is currently X18. And I'm writing to register, so I'm going to give it a brand new register. And now I have X20. That means, in the future, when you look at R8, you actually get X20. Not X13, not X18. I'm now using X20 for this register. Oh, and I have another instruction. So I'm going to do the same thing. R12 is X5. R8 is X20. And this is creating a value, which I'm going to put into my next free spot. Meaning, in the future, when you see R8, you should read X21. This is the process of register renaming. I look up the sources in my table, in this mapping of between architectural and physical registers, and I assign a new register for every destination. So that, and the end result of this is I will never have two instructions writing to the same register, because each write is given a new register. And so if in my code I say I need X20, there can only be one place where X20 is being written. There's only one place to forward from, because I have guaranteed that only one instruction will ever write to that register by renaming it each time I use it. So, if we think about how that will fix this problem, okay, when I am rewriting this problem, each of these is going to be writing to some new register. And in the rewriting process, I'm going to know what the sources actually were, based on whatever the most recent write was, just in the process of rewriting. And so now I don't have to worry about any fancy forwarding. When I come along, actually, it turns out I don't even read from anything for IR move queue. I have no source here, right? There's no source. I don't need, this has no possibility of forwarding. But it's also writing to a different destination. I don't have a write after write problem because I'm writing to different locations. They can't clobber each other. They are separate locations in our register file. And I don't have to worry about where I'm forwarding from because all of my forwarding is unambiguous based on the instructions I was given. Okay? And so similar things happen here. Each of these R8s will actually be a different physical register. And so I can't have any conflict between them because I renamed them as I go along. Now, it gets a little trickier when we think about more complicated instructions, or more variety, I guess I should say, of instructions. So let's look at this instruction set, and we're just going to do the same kind of translation here. So this again is going to be an add of R10 was X19, and R8 was X13, and its destination is going to be a new register, and that means I'm now going to go to X18 for R8. But my next instruction, it has two source registers, but it does not have a destination register. It is a register memory move. So its destination is memory. So I am moving from whatever R8's current value is, which is the value stored in X18, to the address coming from X4. And I'm writing to memory. Okay, we'll come back to how we handle memory. We're not going to rename memory, but we are going to have some challenges when it comes to memory, which we'll see here in two instructions. So let's just keep going. Notice here, because I had no destination register, I didn't take a free register. It's not running a register. I don't need to consume a free register. Nothing in the register map changed. My subtraction, therefore, is still using X18. And R11 was X7. And it is writing to register, so it's therefore writing to a new free register. And that means that in the future, R11 is now going to be X20. And now I have another memory operation. This memory operation has one source register and reads from memory and one destination register. So my move here, it needs to take 8 plus R11, which is X20. And it needs to, and this is also reading from memory, because that's an address. And it's writing that result into a new location, because it's writing to a register. So now this is now talking about X21. Okay? Let's go ahead and do the last instruction, then we'll talk about the weirdness that comes from these memory activities. So this last one, I am adding R11, which is currently X21, and R8, which is currently X18. And add, we've seen before, it allocates a new register, X23, and so R8 becomes X23. Okay, so the process here is I need to think about sources versus destinations. Allocate a new free register over there if there's a register destination. Don't if there isn't. I need to know what the mapping is if it's a source, but not if it's a destination. Okay. But I also have this memory thing. I have a potential problem in my instructions. And the potential problem is, it is quite possible that the address X4 and the address X8 plus X20 happen to be the same address or overlapping addresses. I might have aliasing of these addresses. They might point to the same region of memory, but they might not. And I can't tell from the instructions themselves whether there's a dependency between these two or whether there's not a dependency between these two. Because that depends on the actual memory address in question. So if I'm going to write this kind, build this kind of system that can execute things out of order, memory becomes an additional problem. I have fixed the problems in general with registers by renaming them, but I still have a problem when it comes to memory. There are two basic solutions, two different ways I could fix my memory problem. One is I could say memory must be in order. I could require every memory operation to happen in the original order, no reordering of those, every memory access is dependent on every other memory access. This will give me the correct behavior, and it's fairly easy to implement, but it may, actually often will, cause significant lag. If you think about the programs we've been discussing, our matrix multiplies and our summing of arrays and so forth, many of these go one address after another with no dependency between those addresses. They're all non-overlapping addresses, and yet this will say everything overlaps. So I may be waiting more than I need to do. So that's one option. The other option is I can compare the actual addresses that I create. So I can keep around what is the actual computed address that I'm writing to and reading from, and check these to see if they overlap, and only if they overlap do I stall something. This is quite a bit more work to implement, but allows more parallelism, and because memory accesses are often slow because of cache misses, it's usually worth getting that extra parallelism. So most modern processors do this comparing address. The way we get that to work, and various tricks and tips we can do to make that more efficient, is typically a scope for advanced architecture, CS4330, rather than computer architecture, CS3330. So we're not going to say much more about it. But you should know at least this is actually happening. Your computer is comparing addresses to decide if it needs to stall a memory access or not. Questions? Yes?
I was just wondering, let's say the instructions happen in like a loop. How do we know when like a register is free after we, like if we have a register that's holding a line obsolete, might this clear it out later?
Yeah, when does something ever become free? I said every instruction writing register is grabbing a new one, so when do they ever become free? Well, if they didn't, I would just, my computer could only run as many registers as I have, so that would not be a great idea. Yeah?
When the instruction is done?
What instruction is done?
The instruction that's using that register.
That's not enough.
Or every one is also dependent on it?
If no instruction is using that register, so if no instruction that I've read, so if it's not in my register map, so for example, X23 cannot become free, because I need it to represent X8. But X13 and X8 could, because they're not in my register map anymore. So if they're not in my register map, and they're not being used by any current instruction, either as a source or a destination, then I can pop them over into the free space. And this may sound like a lot of things to check, but I just need to check a variety of locations in my file, and a bunch of various register identifier pipeline registers, for comparison of equality, which is fairly quick to do, and then see an OR of them, which is also fast to do. So I can actually check all of these quite quickly and figure out what is now available. And so that happens to some degree here as I'm thinking about my write back and commit stages. When I'm done doing things, I can check to say, am I actually done with this register? This instruction I am finishing right now, it used these three registers. Are any of them now free? And so each time I go to do that, I can free up some registers and make things go. I could run out of registers. I might not have enough. I might not be able to rename because I have an empty list of free registers. In which case, I'm going to have to stall the rename stage until more registers get freed up. Other questions? Okay. Let's see if it clicked. Do this on your own, and then we'll talk some more. I guess it doesn't have to be on your own. You're welcome to work with each other if you want, but I'm not doing it.
So then with XOR, the RA is XOR 4. And the confidence is that RA is X18.
Questions? All right, let's just spot check our work. When I'm all done in the register file, what does R9 map to? After the last instruction, R9 maps to? X24. Does anybody have questions? All right. This is happening. Your computer does this. It renames every instruction that comes along from the architectural registers, which are programmer abstractions that don't actually exist in hardware, into these physical registers, which really do exist in hardware. And it maintains this map, so that when you ask for an architectural register, it knows which physical register to put into it. And it maintains a list of free registers, so that as you go, it can make sure each register is written by one and only one live instruction. Eventually, that register will become free, and it will be reused. But once it's being reused, no other instructions are dealing with it. So at any given point in time, all of the instructions we've read and renamed and started working on and haven't finished working on are writing to unique registers. And this makes the data dependency problem as simple as forwarding in a regular pipeline. Right? Because the only thing I'm going to have to check once I've done this, came back to our earlier picture here, right? In our simple pipeline, the only thing we had to check was which pipeline register has this value. And we're back to that. Because in our new system, this is writing to something, and this is reading from that thing, and this is writing to something else, and this is reading from that thing and writing to something else. And so when I'm looking to forward my value, I'm looking to forward X2, which is stored here, not there. And so I'll get the right forwarding because I've renamed everything, and not because I have to keep track of what order things arrived in. So I can deal with them in whatever order they appear by renaming them and guaranteeing my math is simple. Okay, so when we do this, we get other extra fancy power. We have a cycle that is changing our instructions. We can change them in fancier ways. For example, remember how messy it was to implement pop? Because pop is changing two registers at the same time, and nothing else is changing two registers at the same time. But we could just turn pop into an add and a move. That's what pop does. And so when we're renaming them, we could rename the instruction, not just the register. So this is what typically happens as part of what we're calling our decode stage. We have these idea of architectural registers. Now we have architectural instructions. Pop is not something we actually need to implement. We could implement pop as two instructions. And then we could rename their registers. So that the things we end up actually running in hardware may not look at all like what we started with. I don't have that iCode. I don't have that register. I have these other things instead. But if I do this in a consistent way, I'll end up with the right behavior. And so my hardware can deal with a simpler set of instructions, deal with them more efficiently without a lot of special case logic, at the expense of changing my instructions. The traditional name for these simpler instructions are micro-operations. This is the micro-architecture. And so these micro-ops, or sometimes people even say the Greek letter for micro, mu-op, but usually they say micro-op. These things don't even have to have any mapping. Here I've just turned one instruction into two instructions that are in our ISA. But in principle, I can map from one ISA to a completely unrelated set of micro-operations if I wanted to, as long as I could guarantee the same semantic behavior. And to some degree, I sort of am, because I'm also turning this two-argument add into a three-argument add, right? Two sources and a destination, rather than a source and source destination. And so we're changing the number of operands. We're changing how many instructions there are. We're changing the instructions you gave me into different instructions that are a better way for my hardware to operate. There's other things that are messy. Condition codes. Ugh, what a mess. We could just turn them into registers. When you give me a compare, I can say, no, actually, my compare doesn't set the condition codes. It can set a register that I'm going to call the condition codes register. And then I'm going to rename that like I would rename any other register. And this way, I can get rid of all these sort of hidden arguments of my instructions. I can make them explicit, and then I can rename them. And then my whole system that I actually run starts looking simpler, easier to implement, and less like what you thought you were running, which makes predicting timing a little trickier. But in general, let me run things in more parallelism, faster, with less resources. I can do one more interesting thing. Notice here, I have a data dependency. That is to say, the add I have created needs to finish before the move can start. But that doesn't have to be the case. I could have instead not had a data dependency by putting an 8 here, right? So I could take the result of the adding and use as my address, or I could use this fact I add as part of my address computation to not have the dependency. So I can change my instructions in ways that you actually couldn't write. There is not any way to write this in your assembly. Because what would this be closest to is putting an 8 here and then a minus 8 there. And that's weird. Or maybe I'm saying the old RSP, right? And these aren't sensible things to say. But I can say them in my microarchitecture if I combine my register renaming and my instruction renaming, everything can work out fine. So I can make my instructions simpler, easier to implement by tweaking them as they arrive. So how do I actually use them? Okay. So once I rename them, they go into this thing we call the instruction queue. The instruction queue is already renamed. My condition codes are renamed as registers. We put a .cc here so you remember their condition codes, because you're probably not used to these instructions having condition codes as an explicit thing. All of my arguments are renamed. All of my destinations are explicit. None of them are implicit. And I also have this thing we call the scoreboard. The scoreboard is just a bit flag for every architectural register. Either it's ready or it's not ready. It's ready if some earlier instruction has written a value to it. It is not ready if they have not. We could actually argue it has written a value to it or it's available via forwarding, and we can actually implement it that way as well. But that's the general concept of our scoreboard. So, what does this mean? Let's suppose I have a multiple issue function, has two ALUs that do all of the work. So these ALUs can run any instruction I have here. And let's see how we can schedule these ALUs. So let's consider cycle number one. We're going to actually look at several cycles. Let me go ahead and write my cycles down here. In cycle one, I need to figure out which instructions are ready. And so I'm just going to start with the first instruction and say, instruction one needs x1 and x5. Both of those are ready, so I can schedule instruction one. That uses up one of my ALUs, but I've got another ALU available. So let's see if I can schedule something else. Instruction 2 needs X2, which is ready, but X6 is not ready. And so instruction 2 is not ready. Instruction 3 needs X7, not ready. X8, not ready. X9, not ready. X8, not ready. I can't run any of the others. So my other ALU is just going to be idle this cycle. It has no work ready for it. And it's just going to sit there empty for this cycle. The next cycle, by the end of this cycle, instruction 1 is going to finish running. And that means X6, which it wrote, is now ready. So in my next cycle, when I go to figure out which instructions are ready, instruction 2 is ready, so I can schedule that. But everything else depends still on something that's pending, and so my ALU2 is still going to be sitting here idle. So now I've run instruction 2. When instruction 2 is finished, X7 will become ready. X7 is going to let me run instruction 3. But everything else depends on something that isn't ready yet. So ALU2, once again, is going to sit idle. When that's done, I've got X8 ready. With X8 ready, I can now run instruction 4. I can't run instruction 5 because we don't have 9 yet, but I can run instruction 6. And this is where I start getting things to begin out of order. I'm going to schedule instruction 6 before I've scheduled instruction 5. And note here that instruction 5 is a jump. So I am actually doing branch prediction here to decide, even to put instruction 6 in my queue, I've already done branch prediction. I've been way back in fetch. So I have this branch prediction that is scheduled for me, instructions 4 and 6. And if it turns out my jump is wrong, I'll have to squash the results of 6. I have to not make them preserved. But I can deal with that later on once I see if the jump works out. So at the end of this round, I'm going to have 9 is ready and 10 is ready. And so in my next instruction, I can do both instruction 5, which uses 9, and I can also do instruction 7, which uses 9. Okay? And then when I'm done with those, I will decide whether I jumped or not. Let's assume I decide I'm okay. And I'll have also written in X11. And then in my last cycle, I've got everything I need to run both 8 and 9. And so I can finish this entire sequence of instructions in just 6 cycles instead of the 9 cycles it would have taken if I was able to do one right after the other. Questions? Yes? Great question. What should I do if nothing is ready? Wait. I dearly hope that if I'm in a situation where nothing is ready, something is getting ready. Otherwise, I've entered a bad state. I'm going to try to design my instruction set so I can't enter a bad state. But there actually will be cases, for example, in a cache miss, where I may just be saying, nothing's ready, nothing's ready, nothing's ready, nothing's ready. Oh, finally, the cache gave me back my answer. I can start doing other work. We are also starting to see some of that latency bound we had talked about last class. I was unable to use my 2 ALUs for the first 3 instructions because these instructions depended on each other. I have a real data dependency between instruction 1, 2, 3, 4. And so I have to do them one at a time because I need the results of one to start the next. But these later instructions, I no longer have that property. I have several instructions that don't directly interdepend. They mutually depend on some earlier stuff. And so I can do them in parallel. And this is going to be how we're actually going to make our code faster by understanding this process. All right, let's come back here. Look at our picture again. Here I drew our functional units. And I mentioned I've got lots of different kinds of them. I have a couple of ALUs. I may even have more than those. But I also have this 2-cycle ALU in addition to my 1-cycle ALU. And I've got my load store, which is going to data memory and might take who knows how long to get back. Okay? So I have various timing, but I also have different functionality. The way I've written this, I could do two adds at once, but I could not do two memory accesses at once. I could actually do two adds and a memory access all at once, but only one memory access at a time. And this is actually a common thing I'm going to do. I'm going to try to analyze what functionality you actually need. Let me give you the functional units that your code tends to exercise. And so, I might have, for example, a system with one ALU and one memory access, a data cache access. Okay? And this is going to give me a different kind of scenario where I might not get everything happening as quickly as I want. So in my first cycle, I can execute MR move queue, which only depends on X4. X4 is ready. So my first cycle, I can go ahead and do instruction, not in the ALU, I can do instruction 1 in my data cache. Instruction 2 is also ready, but I don't have a functional unit to do it in. So even though my ALU is sitting here, I can't use my ALU for that. However, instruction 3 is also ready, and it needs the ALU. And so my first cycle, I can do instructions 3 and 1. And when 3 finishes, I'm going to get X8. And when 1 finishes, I'm going to get X6. And so then in my next cycle, I'm going to say, well, can I do instruction 2? Yes, I can, because my data cache, I assume it's one cycle, is now available again, and X5 is available. So I'm going to schedule instruction 2. And great. Now can I find something for my ALU? Yes, this add can go in my ALU. X6 and X1 are both ready. So I can put that in there. And so when these two are done, I'm going to have 7 and 9 ready. Okay? And so my selection might not only depend on data dependencies, but it also may depend on the availability of the appropriate functional units. All right. Questions about this before we adjust gears slightly? Anything you'd like me to clarify? Okay. Then, let's cast our minds back to pipelining. Just basic pipelining. Without all this out of order and renaming and so on, the idea for pipelining is if I have something that takes multiple cycles, I'm going to start one every cycle, even though it takes several cycles to finish. It turns out that some actual operations, single things I want to do, are actually best done pipelined. For example, multiply is commonly pipelined. If you think about how you multiply on paper, there's a whole lot of individual steps. You're effectively multiplying one operand by a digit at a time of the other operand, writing those all down, and then summing them. And we could take a break in the middle anywhere we wanted. We could say, I'm going to multiply 3 digits, and then I'm going to take a break and push it off to somebody else who's going to do the next 3 digits. And who's going to push it off to somebody else who's going to add them all together. And that's the idea of this pipeline and how we're going to do our multiplies. We're going to take the process of multiplying, divide into 3 chunks in this example, and we're going to pipeline it down. So the ALU1's job is to start multiplying. ALU2's job is to do the middle part of multiplying, and ALU3's job, stage 3's job, is to finish doing the multiply. If I have this pipelined 3-cycle multiply, how many cycles does it take to do A times B times C times D, as parenthesized here? I want an actual number. Take a moment, get that number for me. How many cycles? Question?
After a stage, are there intermediate values that are done being calculated that can be passed for like the next operation, or is that not happening?
If I ask you to multiply a 10-digit number and stop you a third of the way through, what is your intermediate work look like? It's part of some of the digits. So that's what I'm getting here. That's the same idea. There is stuff, but it's not the answer. It's just work towards the answer. Other questions? All right. I'm going to tell you it is 10 or fewer cycles. Hold up the number of fingers you think it is. How many cycles is this? All right, we have half the class not holding up their fingers. I respect that decision. We have numbers as low as 3 and as high as 9. Let's see how I would work through this. C times D, I'm dealing with a pipeline. I'm going to do a pipeline diagram. It needs to go through stage 1, stage 2, stage 3. Because here's a pipeline multiply. I also need to do B times this result. Now, I could start that here, except I don't have one of its arguments yet. Because I need the result of C times D to multiply B by. So I can't start this until the result is available. And similarly, I can't start this other one until its result is available. And so my end result is, in fact, 9. Questions? All right. I can now use the power of algebra to change the answer. I'm just going to say I know that multiplication is associative, meaning I can move these parentheses around. So we're going to just consider what this would look like if instead the programmer had asked me to do this. Move the parentheses according to algebra, this should be the same result. So I'll do this one instead. This one, I now need to do A times B, C times D, and the result of each of them multiplied together. A times B can go through stage 1, stage 2, and stage 3. C times D doesn't depend on it. The values are ready. However, it can't start the first cycle because stage 1 is busy. So I have to wait for stage 1 to be free to enter stage 1. And then the product needs to wait for both answers. And so my end result here is 7 cycles instead of 9. This is what is known as the reassociation optimization. Your compiler won't do this for you. Your compiler won't do this for you, at least for floating point numbers, because different parenthesizations will have different rounding results. So changing where the parentheses are will change the rounding of your answer, which could be significant depending on your application. So if you want to get this, you have to come up with the parenthesization yourself that both has rounding results you can deal with that won't break the numerical stability of your algorithm, but that also minimize the data dependencies you're creating. You want to try to compute multiple things in parallel if possible and then combine them in this sort of vaguely tree-like way. All right. We will commonly have, in a system, some operations that are pipelined. So, for example, I might have 2 simple ALUs that can do the addition, subtraction kind of things. Add, compare, jump. And I might have a 2-stage ALU that does multiply. Let's see how these would be scheduled in that kind of scenario. So if I come in here, I will see that instruction 1 is an add instruction. 1 and 2 are both ready. So I can schedule instruction 1 in my first ALU. Instruction 2 is a multiply operation. It uses 4 and 5, which are both ready. So I can schedule instruction 2 in the first stage of my multiplier. And so instruction 2 is now scheduled. Instruction 3 needs registers 3 and 7, but 3 is pending. Instruction 4 needs registers 3. Oh, that was pending. 9 is pending. 3 is pending. 4 is ready. 6 is pending. And so on. So my other adder and my other multiplier are going to sit idle this cycle. After this cycle is done, X3 will be ready. But I will not yet have X6. Because X6 has only gone through one stage of the multiply. It now needs to enter the second stage of the multiply before it's ready. So as I'm scheduling the other things I want to do this cycle, I now have X3. So I can put instruction 3 here. I have 3 and 7 are both ready, so I can schedule instruction 3. Instruction 4 needs 3 and 8, but I don't have 8. Needs 9, but I don't have 9. However, down here, 1 and 3, I have both of those, so I can schedule instruction 6 in one of my adders. Okay? And, all right, so I've got instruction 6 scheduled. I've still got another adder and another multiplier. Can I do this multiply? No, I don't have 6 yet. Can I do this multiply? I have 3, but I don't have 8 yet. Can I do this compare? I don't have 11 or 13. I don't have 14. So this is all I can do. So one of my adders is still sitting idle this cycle. Next cycle comes along. That means that instruction 6 finishes, so our X11 is now free. Instruction 2 has now finished, so X6 is now ready. Instruction 3 needs to move on to the next cycle. And so on. So we're trying to figure out what's going on. There's a lot of pieces to track by hand. My hardware sort of handles this more or less on its own. When something comes out the other end of an instruction, whatever the operation was, however many cycles that took, we can now mark it as ready and move on. While it's still being worked on, we can't. Questions? Okay. So let's try to summarize some of the limitations of our out-of-order processors. They can do a lot of things at once if we play nicely with them. Okay? So what are some characteristics of these? This is how Professor Rice sort of summarized these ideas. If our instructions depend on unfinished instructions, we're stuck. That's the case we saw with our example on Tuesday, where we had this latency bound. Everything depended on something else, we were limited. However, we, the programmer, can optimize that to make that better. Sometimes the compiler can help us, sometimes it can't. Depends on exactly the behavior of what we're doing. That means we have to track all the uncommitted instructions. So, for example, Intel Skylake, which is the architecture that Professor Rice was using, I haven't checked this on mine, but it's probably similar, has 224 instructions it can be tracking at once. And 168 physical registers. These huge register banks, these huge reorder buffers to deal with putting our instructions back in order, so that I might be holding on to one instruction while running an instruction 200 instructions later. And I'll want to do that, for example, if I have an L3 cache miss. I'll have that kind of latency. An L2 cache miss might do that if I can get enough parallelism in my earlier instructions. The end result of this, though, is that misprediction has a big cost. Misprediction is going to cause me to throw away all of the instructions I have done work on since I predicted the branch. And that, because I'm doing many instructions at once, gets bigger and bigger. And because I have several steps of renaming and reordering and so on I have to handle, that adds extra time to that. And so the average here is about 16 cycles per branch misprediction. So I'm spending a lot of energy trying to make really good branch predictors. Because if I get this even only 10% of the time, I'm still, on average, losing a cycle and a half for every branch. So I want to try to get this as accurate as I possibly can. All right. Yeah, we'll come back to that. Let's look at some code for a bit. Before I look at some code, any questions before I jump to code? Yes? Out of order. Thank you. I should have mentioned that earlier. Other questions? All All right, let's look at some code. Here's our good friend code that we talked about a lot on Tuesday. Hopefully I remember this code. Oh, I still have the plus equals two there. Oops. This is not quite the code we had before. We had this code. Huzzah. All right. And we talked last time about how we can unroll this loop. Okay? To add two values, reducing the amount of loop overhead. But we suggested that this code has this latency bound, this data dependency. When we rename our registers, we're going to find the instructions depend on the instruction before them. And so we're going to be limited in how much we can do. And the reason for that is going to come because every one of our sums has a source that is the destination of the previous sum. It's always this variable, which will be put in a register. And so even with my renaming, every sum instruction is going to depend on the previous sum instruction. I'm going to have this latency bound. That means I'm going to have to do one instruction per cycle, no more than that of my actual summing. The loop overhead is mostly independent of that. I do have some data dependencies between I and my memory accesses, but I only have one of those per loop, where I have two of these adds per loop. And the rest of the things I'm doing in my loop are handling the branch and so on and don't really relate to that. How can we visualize this concept? The way we're going to visualize this concept, your book has a chapter on optimizing code. And this is the visualization they like to use, which I've actually found quite useful. I will sometimes actually use the textbook for this class to optimize my code in my actual life. Okay, so here is how this works. The idea here is I'm going to try to draw a data dependency graph. I'm going to ignore the order of the instructions. I'm going to try to say, what order do things happen in my code? And so this is an example of an unrolled loops data dependency graph. There is some kind of computing an address by adding some increment to a base address. And I'm going to keep incrementing that from action to action. I have to have an address before I can load. I have to have the result of the load before I can add. I have some starting base of my addition, and each of those adds depends on the previous add and the previous load until I eventually get to the sum. Mostly independently of that, I am also checking to see if I have gone past the end of my array. And so the idea here in our data dependency graph is we're going to try to put one row for every level of dependency. So the things in this row could, in the ideal world, all happen at once. If I have enough functional units, have renamed everything correctly, there's no reason these couldn't all happen in the same cycle. And everything in this row could all happen at once. Again, there's no reason they couldn't if I had the thing, but I can't mix the rows. Right? I can't do anything in the second row before the first row because I've got these data dependencies between them. And so I can take the number of rows in the picture as an approximation of how much parallelism my processor could possibly get out of my code. And so I can make it shorter, then I can, in principle, make my code run faster. Okay. And so this is a four-way unrolled loop. It's doing four additions. For just two comparison, maybe it's a three-way. One, two. Yeah, adds three times and checks again. I'm not sure why it's doing the check every three, but anyway, that's what it's doing here, right? But you'll also notice these checks off to the side, they aren't really adding much overhead. I'm not really doing much to those. I'm just checking occasionally to see if I've hit the end. And if my code is working well, that could mostly happen off to the side. Okay? Which we saw here. We saw that we got a little bit more efficient by doing one level of loop unrolling. But once we get one level of loop unrolling, we are just stuck. We're stuck at this one cycle per element. Because that is the height of that parallel flow that we can create. So, what could I do to get more parallelism out of this structure and still get the same answer? Or, equivalently, what could I do to my code? to make this allow me to do more things at once, to not have data dependencies between every line. Yes?
Someone mentioned this last class, but having different variables for the two sums.
Different variables for the two sums? You mean like this? Why would this help?
Because that way, if those two lines of code wouldn't depend on the values of the other line.
Yeah. Notice I'm effectively doing two completely separate sums in parallel. This even numbers are being summed up in one thing, the odd indices are being summed up in another. They never have cross dependencies. And so if I were to think about what this looks like in my picture, I have this. I've got two different sums, sum one and sum two. I am adding half of the elements to one and half of the elements to the other. I have vastly increased my possible parallelism. Okay? Because I've increased my possible parallelism, I may have more contention with my loop overhead. Because that's now going to be more functional units I might have to have operating. So my loop unrolling might become more important. And I don't have to stop at two. I can have as many loop accumulators as I want. This is the optimization the textbook calls multiple accumulators. Because the simplest example is I am accumulating a lot of results in some variable. You accumulate in several variables and then add them up when you are done. Right? Accumulate them in several variables, add them up when you are done. You'll also notice that in order to get to multiple accumulators, I had to unroll the loop as many times as there were accumulators. Because I needed to go to different variables inside the loop. So in order to get two accumulators, I had to do at least twofold loop unrolling so that I could handle the different stages into the different variables. So let's see what this does. So we saw before, with different levels of unrolling, we sort of capped out at one cycle per element. Let's take that 16 level of loop unrolling and try adding more accumulators to it. So this says, all right, I've got 16 levels of loop unrolling for all of these. If I have one accumulator, two accumulators, and so on, now I see I'm getting better than that one cycle per element. I go from one cycle per element to 0.57 cycles per element. And 0.57, and then it gets worse. Okay, two weirdnesses here. Seven, this is not rounding error. There is actually this extra seven there. Somehow. And it's getting worse when I get too many accumulators. So, the 7, let's start there. Where do I get this? Yes?
How did the 1 improve?
How did the what improve?
Yeah, because it was 1.31. And if it's 1, it'll still have 1.
I have 16 levels of loop unrolling.
Oh, and the dashes number.
So that was this row right here. So I'm gonna start with the best I got and then try to make it better. I'm not going to try to optimize something that wasn't already optimal. Other questions? All right, that seven is because I have three instructions of loop overhead every 16 cycles. But those three instructions can be done partially in parallel. And so that literally is 3/16 divided by the parallelism added in here. More levels of loop unrolling will now make this faster. It will drop that 7 down closer to 0. Now at some point we say, I don't care anymore. Is going 0.57 versus 0.52, do I really care about that difference? Well, that's a 10% difference in my runtime. Maybe a 10% difference in my runtime matters, maybe it doesn't. It's up to me to decide if I care about that extra 10% or not. But while my loop unrolling hit as good as it could get with one accumulator, once I had multiple accumulators, suddenly my loop unrolling has a higher possible ceiling. And this is a common trend in optimization. I do one optimization, it makes another optimization useful. I do that optimization, a third optimization may become useful, and so on. The other thing we need to deal with is the fact it gets slower when I get more accumulators. How would it get slower with more accumulators? We had talked, I believe I remember this class last time, but one possible reason that some things can make it slower is because I get worse instruction cache. But multiple accumulators does not increase the size of my code. So I'm not dealing with instruction cache misses. It's something about the actual operation that's slowing down. And to understand that, let's consider how my code turns into assembly. Here I have how two accumulators turns into assembly. If I were to try to extend this to 16 accumulators, I'm going to run into some problems. What problems will I run into? To help us understand that, let's just try turning it into 3 accumulators. So now I need a sum2 variable, which means I need to take this and I need to put it into something other than RAX or RCX. What variable should I, what register should I use? Okay, RDX. How many times can I do that? How many registers do I have? Yes. Sorry? I can't use RDX. I'm already using it. Oh no, what should I use instead? RBX. Okay, great. How many registers do I have to use? Almost 16. I don't have RDX because it's the address of my array. I don't have RSP because I need it for everything. I probably have something about the loop counter floating around here. But at some point, I'm going to end up doing this. These two instructions are doing one extra level of unrolling some point down the line. What are they doing? What is the purpose of these two instructions? Try to articulate the purpose of these two instructions to your to whoever you're sitting next to. Alright, give me incomplete ideas or complete ideas. What's going on here? Anything that helps us decode the activity? Yeah?
Is it eventually just pushing to the stack?
Why did you say the stack?
Put RSP.
Yeah, I've got this RSP floating around here somewhere. And that's a destination, so I'm adding to the stack. Why does it take two instructions? Well, what I want to do is I want to do this. I want to take a value from the array and add it to my destination. But I can't because I can't access memory twice in the same instruction. So I'm actually having to use twice as many... Oh, sorry, that's not what I wanted to do. I'm going to use twice as many instructions to do each add. So at some point I run out of registers. I have to do this thing we call register spilling, put the registers onto the stack instead. And that's going to slow everything down by doubling the number of instructions and maybe also making my memory less useful. Okay? So there's this limitation in how much I can get out of some things is based on other concepts. There are 100 and some odd physical registers. So I don't need to use the stack, except I can't tell the system that I don't want to use it. There is no way to send bytes to my processor that say, use more than 16 registers. There's just no way of saying that. And my computer can't tell, was he using the stack because he ran out of space? Or was he using the stack because he cares about that memory later? Doesn't know. And so has to do what I ask it to do. And so this is a scenario where we find our optimizations start running into limitations. It's also part of the reason why some of the competing architectures, they're trying to compete with the Intel architecture, have more architectural registers so that we can do more levels of loop unrolling and multiple accumulators and so on before we start running into these problems. All right. Yeah, I think that's what we had. Thoughts, comments, questions? Yes? Great question. Why not just add more architectural registers? in my life, they've actually done this. So x86 had 8 registers. x86-64 has 16 registers. Why did they only add 8 more? Yeah. It is not about efficiency, although I understand what you're saying. Think about the code, the y86 you have been using. If I want to keep all existing y86 code working and increase the number of registers, what is the challenge in doing that? Yeah. So it is hard to get the new and old code correct. That is true. But why is it hard? Where in particular does my hardness come? Right? Let's see if I remember my y86 from 3 years ago. Where do I actually... So I have this iCode, iFun, memory serves, that's 1 byte. Is that right? And then I have another byte that needs to have RA and RB. That's only 4 bits per thing. If I want to put 32 registers, how do I tell you where they are? I need to keep all existing instructions, meaning what they are, so I can't just magically say RA is bigger, because I don't want to break your old code. So what I have to do is find some sequence of bits that isn't being used. So to find something like, I realize you're never using iFun 7. So I'm just going to say, if the iFun is 7, then magically I have more bits for RA and RB. And this is actually how x86 really works. It's part of the reason we're not using x86 in this class. Because x86 originally was designed for 16-bit words and only a handful of registers, and it just keeps, in backwards compatible ways, becoming bigger and bigger. And so figuring out how things are encoded involves all these, like, well, if this bit is set, then you go do this, and if this bit is set, you do that other thing. It's just messy. But that messiness is part of the reason it's the dominant architecture. Because when a new version comes out, I can still run all of my old code without having to get the source and recompile. And so that is the reason why it has kept its market share. And every once in a while, somebody comes along. In fact, x86-64 is what we call it now. It was actually not invented by Intel. It was invented by AMD, who came up with this way of adding in more registers to x86, which Intel said, oh, that's a good idea. We'll do that too. There was a bit of argument along the way. Anyway, it's a more complicated story than that. But it's hard to figure out how to do this. On the other hand, I could just say, ooh, I have a cool new idea. We'll do RISC-V. It's a cool architecture. And it is a cool architecture. I quite like RISC-V. I'll bet you can't find a RISC-V processor very easily. Because who's going to buy a processor for which they don't have any code? Right? And so there's this sort of chicken and egg market thing that comes in on top of the technical issues. Any other questions? All right. You'll get to use what we've talked about both to make code more efficient, and in quiz and test questions, they're going to ask you to rename things. So I probably won't see you again. But Professor Rice will see you on Tuesday.